Welcome everybody to another episode of Sandhill Road, and I'm super excited to have my guest with me today here. He's a minor or major celebrity, having had a great appearance on a COVID Ariana Grande and Justin Bieber beefs video. And we're going to talk about this. And let me announce this great guest, Shiel Monod, who's the co-founder of Better Tomorrow Ventures.
Hey, thanks. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And where does this podcast find you today? You have such a beautiful home there.
Yeah, it's a virtual background. You don't want to see what's actually back here. I am in San Francisco and currently in bed. So I had to hide it with this beautiful background.
I'm sorry for waking you up for
this. Oh, no, that's session. Not it at all. I actually just enjoy sitting in bed. And so a lot of my meetings I do in bed. So thank God for virtual backgrounds.
So let's talk a little bit about what you've been up to during COVID, because a lot of people have been sitting at home, you know, working from their bed. And you instead, you made a guest appearance with the Beefs, Justin Bieber.
I'm not sure I'm
going to be able to give you the same publicity, but it had 166 million views. I think the way you made your way into this was actually through the Zoom Bachelorette show.
Yeah, maybe it's true. It's
talk
true,
a little bit about it.
It's such a weird story. Okay, so there was something at the beginning of the pandemic. There was this show called the Zoom Bachelorette, where there was this woman and there were 12 of us suitors on this 3-hour show trying to win her affection, so to speak. I ended up losing on the show. It was a fun thing. We had to like give ourselves a haircut. We had to cook a meal, all these other things. I did not win. I came in third, I believe, or maybe fourth. But I think I did well with the audience. So they ended up choosing me to be the Zoom bachelor. Which was a few months later.
I know I'll be a phenomenal husband. Like all VCs, I'm always asking the question, how can I be helpful?
And then sort of watching this Zoom Bachelorette was Scooter Braun, who is Justin Bieber and Ariana Grande's manager. And we were in Clubhouse afterwards and he said, oh, I'm shooting this music video right now. I got to get you on it. And so we did it. And so in this Stuck With You music video, I think it's somewhere near the 2-minute mark. I have like a 2 or 3 second appearance. It's kind of funny.
And sporting this great mustache. It's wonderful. But maybe let's jump in with something I read on your website, which is called shiel.wtf. And you mentioned there that you're generally a happy yes man, a very pronoid person. And then you kindly link to the Wikipedia article on what pronoia means. And it's a neologism coined to describe a state of mind that is the opposite of paranoia, whereas a person suffering from paranoia feels that persons and entities are conspiring against them. A person experiencing pronoia feels that the world around them conspires to do them good. That's such a wonderful Zen state of mind to be in. And I think it's probably a state of mind that you have to be in if you're a venture capitalist, right? Always look and think about the upside. I love this. So talk a little bit about what this entails in your daily life, this pronoia.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. As a VC, you should be pronoia. You should have pronoia because you should be thinking about what could go right, not necessarily what could go wrong. Because especially in the world of venture capital, as you know, a lot of things can go wrong and one thing go right and you still have an amazing fund, business, whatever. So It's a good way to live life if you can, but I don't think most people have the choice. I think I just lucked out that's how I tend to see the world.
Yeah, and I think if I look at your background, sort of required because you've transitioned through so many roles over the last couple of years, sort of this state of mind is really required. And maybe for the listeners out there, we originally met back in 2016, 2017, I think, early 2017 it might have been.
Yep.
In a startup class at UC Berkeley. You were teaching together with Neil Dougal, who was at that point the general counsel for 500 startups. You taught me quite a lot about unit economics, but you're a person who has worn many hats, starting out as a management consultant, then becoming an entrepreneur, then an angel investor, and now a fund manager. Maybe just give us the quick highlights of your last couple of years, couple of decades.
Yeah, absolutely. it's funny because like the way I tell the story, it like kind of makes sense and like flows from one to the next. But I think in reality, it's not always that way. It's like, you know, there's that famous Steve Jobs quote about connecting the dots, looking backwards, and you can kind of see how it all ties in together. But really at the time, it was always like, I don't know what I'm going to do next. Let me think about it. And then something landed in my lap. It happened to be turned out great. I grew up in Pittsburgh. I went to Carnegie Mellon. I made software for hospitals. From there, I was working in hospitals and transitioned into management consulting, also in the healthcare space. And then, you know, I was just like, wanted to do something different. And I also wanted to like give back. So I spent a year working in microfinance in India at Kiva. And that was a really cool experience because I decided to live like a borrower. So Kiva is a microfinance institution, a website where you can make a loan to an individual in the developing world. And I moved to India and lived like a borrower. So, you know, I was living on about $2 a day. That was a tremendous experience. I then came back to the States, went to business school, worked at BCG. At BCG, also was ready to leave. And a friend of mine had left a couple months earlier to start a company. And he said, oh, why don't you join me? So I did that. It was a payments company called Fee Fighters. We got acquired by Groupon. And so that was an interesting story itself. And then stayed at Groupon, ended up starting a couple of other things along the way. One of which is an auction company called Innovative Auctions. And then I also sort of while doing that, decided to start a couple other things, which were a food company called Thistle. And then this podcast that you're familiar with called The Pitch that was subsequently acquired by Gillnet, which was acquired by Spotify. And then in 2015, we sort of sold the auction business and 500 startups had invested in my first company and asked me to join. So I came on board to 500 startups at the end of 2015, originally as a temporary like help out sort of thing. Then I decided to run a fund, 500 FinTech. It's a small fund, $15 million. I just loved it. I think I love helping startups at the earliest stages. And, you know, I was fortunate to choose an amazing category, FinTech, especially at that time, I think was a little bit ahead of what other people were thinking in FinTech. So those companies have done really phenomenally well. And I continuing that FinTech investing is the new fund called Better Tomorrow Ventures, which we raised last year.
Yes, and we'll get to that. But before that, let me maybe as a content creator myself, double click on the pitch, which I really,
sure.
It's near and dear to my heart. I can't wait for it to continue. I think it's been stuck on episode 100. Maybe it's been discontinued. I'm always checking back in. Actually, 2 weeks ago, I had another flashback. There was the founder of Cow Chopper Coffee, the Vietnamese pour over coffee.
Yeah.
That pitched on Shark Tank. And yeah. I think you originally set out to sort of make it a more real Shark Tank. And so now the circle closes, right?
Yeah,
in a sense that one of the babies from the pitch is now, I think they got a deal from Robert Hershovic for...
Yeah, that's right.
$600K for 5% and I think some advisory shares. And as you mentioned, you sold it to Gimlet, which as we all know is next to Anchor, the big acquisitions from Spotify in the podcasting space. But talk a little bit about how it all started, because I think you started it in your home, listening to a pitch and just hitting the record button. And so often, you know, as an investor, I wish I could hit the record button in my daily life, but you actually did it and you turned it into a wonderful podcast.
It started, I think I was sick and I was at home, like wanting to do nothing, sitting on the couch. And I turned on the TV and was watching Shark Tank, got pretty hooked on it. And I really enjoyed watching it. But I was thinking, hey, this isn't real. This isn't what real startups pitch like. You know, on Shark Tank, you have like a towel with a hole in it or something like that, getting a lot of attention. That's not what venture capital is like. Or that's not what our type of venture capital is like. So, what if I made something that was like Shark Tank just via podcast? You know, at that time, podcasting was just starting to get very popular. And if I just record what people are pitching me. So that was the original idea. I contacted this guy, Josh Muccio, because he had a podcast about Product Hunt. And I thought we could work together on this. And we did. And so that was in the beginning of 2015. He was living in Florida. He came out to San Francisco and we recorded the first several episodes in my house. And actually we, for the first couple of years, the logo was a edited picture of us in my house. Originally, it was me being the only voice interacting with the company. And then over time, we evolved it to actually being much more similar to Shark Tank. We started recording in a studio and we had four or five VCs with one company pitching. And so it ended up being a lot more like Shark Tank. So we started in 2015. At the beginning of 2017, Apple featured us on their podcast app. So like if you opened up the podcast app at the top screen, like there was a picture of me and Josh with the pitch. And we had, when we originally launched, we had a successful launch on Product Hunt, and that actually went a really long way. And we got somewhere, I don't remember, but we were one of the top podcasts for that brief moment. And then it happened again in 2017. And in 2017, Gimlet reached out to us and said, "Hey, we've been listening to your podcast for a while. We have this podcast called Startup, and we think you might be a perfect complement for us. So would you consider joining Gimlet?" And then we did. They then got acquired by Spotify a year plus later. And I am sad to report to you that it looks like they're not going to continue.
Oh my God. That's what I was thinking, that they left it on episode 100. But for anyone listening out there, you should definitely look at the back catalog. It's so amazing. And I mean, Josh Muccio,
he's such a great host.
And he would always follow up with, you know, the investors ex post. How did it go down? How did the closing happen or not? Moving on from the podcast, which I think is really like a masterpiece that will stay in the internet universe. Moving on to your way into the wonderful world of venture. And I think, you know, today we have this notion of the career venture capitalist, people starting out in the big firms as associates, you know, working on the top of the funnel, you know, talking to lots of companies to become principals, then partners, then, you know, fighting for carry points. But we all know that the prime way of getting into venture is by actually having founder authority and having actually been in the trenches as an operator, preferably having founded a company, have an exit under your belt. But the way that you describe it, this wasn't really planned. It was more like spuriously.
Yeah.
I can imagine that, you know, still knowing about this perspective of being in the founder trenches, having to find product market fit, must have really shaped your thinking around a lot of things, starting from unit economics to UX, UI, backend infrastructure, everything in between. Talk a little bit about all of these aspects and why this makes you a better investor today.
It is really helpful to have that background. And I think where it's helpful is it gets you respect from founders. And I think it helps you win deals against somebody who may not have that founder background. And I think what we talk about a lot is founder empathy, because starting a company is not easy and you go through a lot. And both myself and my partner, Jake, have been through that and have been through some really tough times along the way. And we can guide founders to a certain extent. And then the other thing is, like, especially because we're focused on fintech, a lot of the problems that a founder might face, we have done before. That has worked out really well for some of our founders. So I don't think it's a requirement, but I do think it's really helpful. And I think our founders would say that they probably talk to us a lot more than some of their other investors. And I think a big part of that is because we are founders and that's our approach.
Maybe let's talk a little bit about the 500 Startups FinTech Fund. I think it was originally targeted to be a 25 million fund. You ended up raising 15 million. Talk a little bit about how that sort of fit into the whole 500 Startups ecosystem. You know, was it its own accelerator? Was it more like a sidecar investing alongside the main batch? How did it work and how did it come about originally?
Yeah, sure. I joined 500 Startups towards the end of 2015. The idea was I would be a mentor and, you know, figure out if I liked doing it, and then I might do it on my own. So it turned out I really enjoyed it. I love helping founders at the earliest stages. And then I thought, okay, I want to do my own thing, but maybe I should do it here under 500. So we set up a separate vehicle, 500 FinTech, originally funded with my own capital and then raised a fund around it. And you mentioned, yeah, it was supposed to be 25 million. How did it end up being 15? What ended up happening was while I was raising, 500 startups had some issues, you may recall, and the Me Too stuff, just for clarity, had nothing to do with me. Because of that, we had some LPs drop out and ended up becoming a bit challenging. So I decided to actually just keep the fund small. And then I knew sort of I could go out again and raise another fund, assuming things went well. And things went really well. And I do think, you know, I credit 500 startups with really giving me a chance and a first path into venture that I don't know if anyone else would have given me. So, you know, I really enjoyed my time there. And there we ran an accelerator program focused on fintech. And it was an entirely separate fund. The fund, you know, was separate, but in the accelerator companies, we would jointly invest with the 500 startups fund. So we would put up half the capital in every company, and the 500 startups main fund would put up half the capital. And we ran an accelerator. We had, I think, five or six batches with, you know, 6 to 10 companies apiece. You know, a lot of really great companies have come out of there. And so I think I was really fortunate in choosing this fintech category and being able to find these amazing founders to work with. And then that, you know, of course, paid dividends. That fund has performed extremely well. And thanks to that, you know, it gave us the ability to raise this Better Tomorrow Ventures Fund, which is 75 million. And that one, you know, actually we were targeting 60 million, but there was a lot more demand than we had expected. I think given my experience raising the first time was very hard. And then kind of what other people told us to expect in raising this fund, that for me and Jake was the first time raising an institutional fund together. People had told us, you know, actually somebody, you know, very popular in the venture community had told us, you guys are crazy. You should raise a $30 or $40 million fund. You're not going to be able to raise 60. But we decided, okay, we already said we were going to raise 60. So let's just raise 60. And then it ended up being that we were way oversubscribed at 70 and ended up closing at 75 because that was the hard cap. Sort of, you have to set a hard cap when you're raising, and ours was set at 75.
Yeah, I think it's an impressive amount for what is considered by institutional LPs a first-time fund.
Yeah.
But what I like about your fundraising is that sort of when you raised the 500 Startups FinTech Fund, you were part of the track record, actually, of the 500 Startups track record.
Yeah,
among
true.
Other companies like Credit yeah. Karma, Flywheel, Simple, I think iMoney and Realty Shares I saw in the pitch deck there. That's quite a luxury to be part of, you know, the track record there as yeah. a founder. And then sort of built from this the first maiden fund and then raised the first independent fund a couple of years later. And if we talk a little bit about the original thesis for the 500 Startups FinTech Fund and how this has evolved, I think it was focused on serving millennials in the financial services sector, which played out quite well, talking about meme stocks and Robinhood and neobanks and all of
yep.
this. How has this really evolved now in the last 5 years as the fintech ecosystem has really, really matured in many ways?
I think it has gotten a lot easier to start a fintech company. And so that means there are just more of them and there are more great founders choosing to start a fintech company. So an example would be Simple. Simple was a company that 500 Startups had backed. It was one of the original neobanks started by a friend of mine, Shamir. Simple took really like $10 million in 2 years just to get to launch. Huge team. They had to build everything themselves. They had to, you know, convince the bank to partner with them. They had to build their own compliance infrastructure, their own credit, all this stuff they had to do themselves. And today, if you wanted to start Simple, it would take a team of two or three people like 6 weeks to start the company, the bank, and be live issuing cards. There's a company in our portfolio called Unit.co. It's a banking as a service company that enables that. And we've seen this actual thing happen where literally a company goes from meeting Unit in 6 weeks, they have cards in hand as a new bank, a neobank. And that's pretty exciting. And so what that means is like the world of opportunities has expanded greatly. And it's not just what you would historically think of as fintech companies. there are all these other companies that are really providing software plus. So it's software plus financial services, not just financial services. And another example in our portfolio is a company called Coast. It's a fleet spending card. There are these two companies, WEX and FleetCor, that are quite large, like $10 and $20 billion businesses. And all they are is like a MasterCard or Visa, but it's focused on fleet payments only. And Coast, we said, hey, these companies actually have horrible NPSs. Let's build some software on top of a card so you can manage the fleet spending. And it's similar to Ramp or Brex, where it's not about the card per se, it's about the software plus the card. And I think there are a lot more of these sorts of companies that are being built. If you think about like Mind Body Online, which is software for yoga studios, they really are doing everything that the person running the yoga studio needs to do. They're the software that person needs. So it handles payment, it handles scheduling, it handles marketing to a certain extent. So why not then, if you're already handling payment, why not add in other financial features and be a bank account? You're already the place where, you know, they're swiping a credit card or taking electronic payments. You can do more from a banking perspective. And we think a lot of companies will add in banking services. And companies like Unit will be enabling that. And so we're invested, of course, in the infrastructure piece with Unit, but we also are investing in some of those other companies that are being enabled by Unit. And that's exciting.
That's super interesting because, you know, if I think about neobanks, I today think about it as mainly like a distribution mechanism. And, you know, every other week you have a new neobank focused on a different vertical. And it raises some questions in terms of defensibility. But what you're mentioning there is saying that you have sort of a vertical SaaS layer and then you link in a fintech angle to sort of
exactly
to entrench it. Maybe talking a bit about the back end side of the fintech ecosystem. And we have some companies such as Plaid being a really interesting data play. Then we have the payment processors, the likes of Stripe.
You know, it's really exciting. I think both Plaid and Stripe enable so much to take place, kind of like what we were talking about just now, how there'll be a lot more fintech companies being started. Plaid really made it easier to get that bank account information, which meant a lot of personal finance managers, made it easier to look at bank information to underwrite loans, all sorts of other things.
Yeah, I remember, again, an early podcast episode with the founder of Plaid, where he mentioned that in the first version of Plaid, they actually had to go and build like a web scraper that went into the bank accounts and scrape the data. You know, it was really the version one of the data integrators. And now we can sort of link directly into an API and everything is quite seamless already.
And what happens with these sorts of companies is like, you build it for one use case and then other people find it and start using it for other use cases. And Stripe, it used to be a decade ago, you have to go to your bank and open a merchant account with your bank and then separately get a gateway. And that process took a couple of weeks. And then with Stripe, you could sort of integrate a couple lines of code and be up and running instantly. That really changed a lot for online commerce. And I think that's, you know, tremendously exciting. And I continue to be bullish on both of those companies.
Let's talk a little bit about Better Tomorrow Ventures. And you mentioned already that you exceeded the target and closed at the hard cap of 75 million. Talk a little bit about the fundraising and how having had a number of angel syndicates helped you build trust among LPs.
Yeah, absolutely. So we started fundraising towards the end of 2019. And we sort of had to jumpstart our process because we had a company we wanted to invest in. It was actually Unit, the company we talked about. And we had committed to investing in Unit in September 2019. We committed to, you know, sort of co-leading the seed round. But we didn't have money at that time. We hadn't actually started raising the fund. In fact, when we committed to investing, we didn't even have a pitch deck for the fund. So we committed to invest and we said, okay, the money's coming. And then sort of like 3 months later, we had, we had put together a pitch deck and then sort of quickly raised a first close, which was something like $20 million. And that $20 million was relatively easy for us to raise. I think we have a good enough track record and reputation in the world of fintech. So a lot of fintech founders and other VCs just sort of said, okay, you guys are starting a fund, we're going to invest. And that was really great. And we had some really amazing people, you know, just sort of say like very quickly, like Mark Andreessen gave us $2 million. And that was our first LP, actually. It was pretty nice. We, you know, had a meeting with him. He had been, you know, recruiting both of us to various times to Andreessen. And then when we said we're going to do this fund on our own, he said, all right, you've made the right decision. And here's the first check, which was very sweet of him. So that first, what ended up being close to $20 million, was relatively easy. I had my previous fund. Most of those LPs came in as well. And then we went out to institutions. And that is just a longer sales cycle. It tends to be, they want to get to know you over a 3, 4, 5 month period. I think in hindsight, we should have had those meetings earlier on, but you know, whatever, we lesson learned. We did have one institutional fund come into our first close. It was Sundana Capital. It's a seed fund, seed focused fund of funds.
Yeah, big fan of Michael Kim from Sundana. I love his concept and how he's really able to emphasize hungry over proven. And so really happy to have seen him come in as an LP.
What was amazing and why we'll forever be grateful to them is they came in before anyone else without anything else. No, you know, there's always, it's always easier to be the last investor in a fund when, you know, eventually we got a lot of institutions to come in, but, and then it's easier to say, oh, these guys have done their homework. But Michael not only came in early, not just Michael Graham and Kelly as well. Sundana came in early, but also I think we didn't know perfectly what we were doing. We had a vision. We didn't have, you know, we didn't have everything drawn out perfectly, but he helped us sort of build that and it, we're super grateful for him. And then sort of beginning of last year, so beginning of 2020, we started going out to other institutions, and these were just people that we could get connected to in one way or another through other VC friends of ours, their LPs, that sort of thing. And it went pretty well. It took time, but things were going really well. And then we were going to do a close March 30th, 2020. And you know, as you probably recall, the world looked kind of crazy at that point. And all of this capital that we had committed or nearly committed basically said, hey, the world is falling apart. We don't know what's going on. We cannot commit this money to your fund. So we had a number of people actually back out. And, you know, it's okay. We totally understand that was a crazy time. And so we kind of just paused fundraising for a little bit. And we thought, okay, we have 20 million now. We probably could easily get to 30 or 40, but getting that 60 might be hard. So then we thought, we sent a letter to our LPs and said, hey, like, we've rethought this. We're going to have a smaller fund, but it's okay because valuations are going to come down. And then, of course, what ended up happening was, you know, 2 months later, the market was back higher than it ever been. And valuations, you know, sort of subsequently really high. And it was actually fairly easy for us to close out the rest of the fund. I think we were seen as a credible group with a very good track record in a, you know, starting a new fund. And so we ended up getting a lot of institutions coming in. We have, count among them, Greenspring, Industry, Invesco, Vintage, and Sundana on the fund of fund side. And then we also have a number of wonderful family offices. And then we have my alma mater, Carnegie Mellon, among others. So like a really great mix of LPs that we love working with. I wasn't sure how that would all be, but we actually have a really great relationship with them, and we've been doing a lot of SPVs, and a lot of our LPs love that. So that's been great too.
We love having co-investments. It's the taste of the time.
It's exactly.
Yeah. But let's talk a little bit about differentiation. I think it's an interesting topic because venture is really one of the few asset classes where the asset chooses the money. Right. And yeah, and we talked about exactly. You and your co-founder of Better Tomorrow Ventures having this founder authority. But then the game is more complex, you know, because the stage at which you invest in the pre-seed seed stage, there your job is really to pass the ball along to the later stage investors. And obviously having someone like Marc Andreessen as an LP is a perfect way of ensuring that you can pass along this ball. Maybe talk a little bit about the different ways in which you would consider yourself differentiated in the fintech, early stage fintech space.
Yeah, I think, you know, sort of our pitch is we are fintech founders investing in fintech founders. And at the seed stage, we think it's most helpful to have people who've been through it before. It's when you need the most support. So what I recommend to founders is at seed stage, you go with the investor that is going to add the most value to you at that stage, which is somebody who's been through it before and somebody who has experience in the field that you're in. At Series A, we say, just go for a strong brand. A brand can be very helpful in sort of, you know, recruiting and other things. And then Series B and beyond, you know, just go for the best price you can get. And if you didn't get one of those things, if you didn't get a brand, if you didn't get a helpful founder turned VC, then you can get it in the next stage. So that's what we recommend. I think the main thing that differentiates us, frankly, is that, like, we love this stuff. Like, this is what we love doing. We love helping our companies. You know, we're in WhatsApp with our founders all the time. We think that, you know, I think for the most part, we're the first call for entrepreneurs. Something good happened, something bad happened. You know, they always tell us, you know, this, I just got off the phone and I had to call you. And we love that. We've helped hire people. We help think through distribution. I think Jake has done a lot in helping build company culture. I do a lot on like strategic partnerships. And then we definitely help raise the next round. A lot of our companies have had a lot of success there. And a lot of time during that few week process of the raising the next round, we are always on the phone with our founders, but then also with the VCs, convincing them, here's why this company is amazing. And it goes a long way. It really helps.
You haven't been through the full cycle yet, but when do you think will be the point when you have to let go and let the later stage investors take the ball? It's a great sign if the founder still calls you at the Series D, but how have you thought about this?
We have a bunch of companies that are Series C, Series D. We have companies that's going public. And all of those companies, I would say we still have a very strong relationship with. You know, the companies from 500 FinTech, not from the new fund. The new fund, we don't have any companies at that stage yet. But I'd say all of our Series C and beyond companies, I talk to the founder or message with them multiple times a month still. So I think we're still pretty active. And some of them, like, multiple times a week still.
This brings me to the next topic, reserve capital. And you had to do a fund model, obviously, for this fund. I assume that in the 500 Startups FinTech Fund, you couldn't go all the way. Taking your pro rata would have been beyond the size of that fund. But now that you have a larger fund, you can think about keeping your pro rata for a couple of rounds or even having a larger allocation. How do you think about that in this current fund?
It really feels like looking back, the 500 FinTech Fund, I'm really kicking myself for not keeping the pro ratas in a lot of those companies, because I think I didn't put as much money into those follow-ons as I should have. I knew which companies to follow on into. Like, if you look at the follow-on, the companies that I followed on into, they were the right companies, but I just didn't put enough capital behind it. Like, I would double in instead of like going all in on these follow-ons. And it turned out that, like, of course, I'm still learning so much, but that was a big learning for me, was like, you can spot a winner and just pour the gas in when you can. So in this fund, we have 1-to-1 ratio of first checks to follow-ons. And a lot of LPs and other GPs had told us it's going to be hard to get more than that because the nature of investing today, it's hard to get your pro rata rights. It actually hasn't been hard for us, though. We've been able to get them. And I think it's because, you know, because of that, like, being the founder's first call sort of thing. It also helps that, like, we're helping them raise the next round. So we spend a lot of time with the investors that are writing that lead check at the Series A and B. So they don't want to screw us. So that has been really helpful. So we've been able to maintain our, and in some cases, we've been able to grow our ownership over time.
And a lot of first-time funds, I see it all the time. They don't have enough reserve capital. The performance is driven so much on your ability to double down. So keeping that in mind early on, I think makes a lot of sense.
So actually in fund two, we probably will have more reserves. So right now we're 1-to-1. I think we'll have more reserves and sort of really go all in.
For the last part of our session, I want to start a new format, which I call the good, the great, the bad, and the ugly.
Look wow. at some
of your great deals. Maybe starting out as a first one, Chipper Cash evolving really nicely. I think you announced the 100 million Series C after your investment. I think Ribbit Capital, which is really the largest 6th, 7th generation fintech fund, came in. So you really establishing yourself as being an early signal for those later stage investors.
So this company, you know, I met the founders at the end of 2018. You know, they told me their idea. Majid actually still had not left his company. So it was only, Ham was the only full-time employee at that time. But I really liked what they were building. And I thought they were incredibly thoughtful. They had really great reactions to anything I brought before them. And then so chose to bring them into the accelerator. So we invested at that time. It was 150K at a 2.5 million post, and love working with them in the accelerator. Very fast learners, always sort of like had tremendous growth week over week. And then we thought, hey, this could really be something. Towards the end of the accelerator, nobody had wanted to invest in the company still. So I ended up writing another check into the company to sort of keep them alive for a little bit.
Maybe for the listeners, give some background on why it was so difficult, because I think it's a African fintech, a underserved sector.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't do a good job explaining. So Chipper Cash is a peer-to-peer payments product in Africa. Think about it like Venmo or Square Cash in the United States, or, you know, a cool analog would be like WeChat Pay or Alipay in Africa, or Paytm in India. There's a great need for this product in Africa because the unbanked population is so large. So I really like these founders, wanted to invest, made that second investment. And then fortunately, a friend of mine, Dan Kimmerling at Decians Capital, came in and ended up doing the next round, did the seed round after the accelerator. And I think it was a real challenge for those guys to raise because it's an African payments company. And especially at that time, many investors were not looking to invest in Africa. Many investors were actually not investing outside of the United States at all. And now many more of them are. And we've seen funds like USV, who hadn't done any international investing at all, just did the last two deals were international. So I think we're seeing a lot more of that. And the pandemic has made it easier. If you're not meeting the founders anyway, or you don't have to travel to board meetings, you know, things are definitely a lot easier.
And I think that's another superpower of you, having lived on $1 or $2 in an emerging country for a year, collecting garbage. So having this founder empathy for also out of region, out of Silicon Valley founders, I think that's a superpower that you have there. And then maybe moving on to really your best deal so far. I mean, there are a number of examples. I know Flexport, Ryan Peterson was actually in the same lecture series that you presented in Berkeley. But maybe let's talk about the one on top of your mind that's sort of your shield-defining venture deal so far.
Sure. I think, yeah, Flexport is a good one. Albert might be another. Let's use Flexport because it was one that I invested in pretty early. So I was a seed investor in the company, but I mean, I invested in early as in early for me when I was just starting to do venture capital investing, angel investing. I met this founder and just immediately loved the guy. He was so scrappy. At the time, we both were doing this hack to get free Ubers, which was...
He invited me for a beer after the session in Berkeley, and then he took the BART back to San Francisco. And that was after his Series B, I think. He was so scrappy even back then.
So we were both doing this hack where we were... You had an Uber referral code, and you would get a certain amount of money. I think it was like 20... They varied. And so the sort of scam, so to speak, worked better or worse, depending on how it varied. But like, they would give you like $10 or $20 or $30 if somebody knew you referred somebody new to Uber. And so we just started using Google AdWords to market our own Google promo code, Uber promo code. So if you search for Uber, you would get like, use my promo code and save whatever on your first ride. And we were both doing this thing, and we were both like, man, we have a lot in common. This is cool.
Yeah, extreme couponers. Yeah.
Extreme couponers.
There's this tech edition. TLC episode on these. It sounds like a great common interest. Yeah.
And so we started hanging out, and, you know, I learned his background. He had been an importer from China, and then he started this company, Import Genius. And he, you know, he just I just thought, like, this is the kind of guy you want to back. So when he, you know, when he told me sort of the idea about what he wanted to do, I said, I'm in, like, I want to invest. And I actually didn't have much liquid capital at the time, but I gave him a large check compared to what I had. And that was actually before YC. I just really liked the guy. And I learned so much through that process as well. You know, going, helping him fundraise for his seed round. I ended up getting a bunch of my buddies to invest in the company. It wasn't necessarily like the hottest company. Like, it was, there were a lot of investors in that round. And it was like, some of them were just like friends of mine that I was able to bring in into the company. And today, in, you know, like a hot round company, you have to like really show how much value you're going to add. And the lead investor tries to take most of the round. And so, you know, it was a different time. And then I also got to see the company grow over time. Saw when he met Peter Thiel and Founders Fund ended up investing and have sort of been along for the ride, which has been wonderful.
Yeah, no, he's such a great entrepreneur. And I think he has still this vigor and focus, even after the Masa private offering, the MPO that some people call it.
That's really funny. I haven't heard that.
Maybe let's move on as a last point to a postmortem of one of the deals or investments that went sour and how this has really shaped you as an investor, because it's just the economics of venture. And if you're a good venture investor, and I subscribe to the Adam Street model there, that actually the loss rate at the early stage correlates with, you know, how well the fund ends up returning, that you take bold bets, but sometimes they are too bold and looking back, you would not have taken them. Talk a little bit about the deals that went sour.
Yeah. You know, I'd say like, I don't have any like amazing stories here. I would say the lesson learned is, so of course, first of all, of course we have many failures, to your point. The largest lesson learned to me was at seed, just focus on the founders. A couple of stories of failure come to mind that are really just the founder gave up and they didn't have the will to do it anymore. And so you really want to find founders that have a hunger for what they're doing, and will figure out a way to make it work no matter what it is. Other sort of the ugly stories are really where I didn't do enough homework on the founder. Had I done more background research, I would have uncovered something funny that would have caused me not to invest. So, you know, those are lessons learned. And fortunately, they were learned in a fairly cheap way, because they were, you know, lessons learned in a small fund that already had done super well. Those are sort of lessons. Do your background research, bet on founders you believe in, and they'll figure out a way to make it work.
Yeah, that's great. I think it's a great Paul Graham lesson also, that most startups die of suicide and not murder.
Yeah, that's the way to put it. Yeah.
So Sheel, as we're running against the clock, thank you so much for being here with us. I didn't mention this at the top of the show, but you're actually a icon on VC Twitter, almost 30,000 followers by now and being really active. I've been following you for a couple of years now. Maybe talk a little bit about how people can find out more about you and what you're up to. I saw that you're going to present at the launch conference, Jason Calacanis launch conference.
I think the easiest way to follow along is to follow me on Twitter at PitDesi, PITDESI. And yeah, I'll be at the Jason Calacanis conference, meet a VC. I'll be pitching myself, which will be fun. But yeah, I think Twitter is probably the easiest way to follow me.
Wonderful.